Deborah Gillespie earned her AB in philosophy at Barnard College in 1977. In 1980, she graduated from the Brooklyn Law School with her JD and was admitted into the New York State and federal bars in 1981. Now, Deborah must be a public radio listener because two advanced degrees simply were not enough. In 1988, she earned an MA from the University of Chicago Graduate Library School. Her master's thesis, Communication and Contract, Implications for Natural Language Processing. She is currently ABD at Chicago. Good luck with that dissertation.
They closed the library school while I was going to it.
Oh, man, bummer.
That's why I'm ABD.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry to hear that. In her spare time, Deborah is the curator of the Chicago Jazz Archive. Today she's here to tell us about the jazz that made Milwaukee famous, newly digitized tapes from the John Steiner Collection at the Chicago Jazz Library. Please join me in welcoming one of the busiest persons in the Midwest, Deborah Gillespie.
Thank you very much for coming. I have to ask that no one tape this because there are some copyright issues with some of these recordings, and I'll explain why as we go further along. But we don't own the rights to the Paramount recordings that John Steiner had. He actually sold that to George Buck. And though I believe I'm within fair use, I don't want to take any chances. Okay. We're going to start with a brief chronology. John was born in 1908 on July 21st. Is this doing okay? Can you guys hear everything? I'm getting kind of a back thing on this. Okay. He went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He graduated with a BS and a PhD in chemistry in 1933. Well, we know what 1933 was. That was the Depression. He was actually an industrial chemist, and that was how he made his money to support his 78 habit. He and Hugh Davis met actually going over the 78 bins at a local record store. They decided to start S&D Records together. Davis was ill. He sold half of his half of the interest to John. And he died, I believe, in 46. Might have been 49. John Steiner was living and recording at the Uptown Theater. When fire gutted the building, he lost the S&D back stock, but not the metals. From the 1940s to the 90s, John recorded jazz and oral histories at clubs and in his Chicago and Milwaukee residences. He lived in Chicago for a while, but he was born here and he returned here. He acquired Paramount from Wisconsin Share Factory December 12, 1949, and he sold Paramount to George Buck on September 18, 1970. You may wonder why the precision on the dates, and that is that we found the contracts, so we know what the actual dates were. He passed away on June 3rd in Milwaukee at his home. This is just an overview for what's to come. That's John in the center down at the bottom from his high school yearbook. He went to Bayview High School here in Milwaukee. It probably was not part of Milwaukee at that time, but it is now. He was an industrial chemist. He was later on the faculty at the University of Illinois Chicago, which was called Chicago Circle at that time. It would have been in the 70s. So Steiner and Davis met at a record store, and they decided to team up and record local musicians. Now, here's a picture of John recording local musicians. As young as he is, that probably is somewhere around 1940. I have no idea who the musicians are. It's going to take some digging to find that out. But there he is, holding up his microphone. Now, they formed S&D Records in 1944, and the S&D 78s are of two kinds. If you notice the top one, it's a re-release of Froggy Moore Rag, okay? This was not previously identified. Bill Russell, Roy Carew, Paul Miller, George Hoffer, and other people confirmed that was not one that was known. If you look at the bottom one, Tut Soper was actually playing in Chicago at that time, so he was a contemporary musician, and so these were new recordings. Okay, in 1945, Hugh sells his share in S&D to John. So here's John living and recording in the Uptown Players Theater. He'd managed to attach himself as sort of a general dog's body. He, you know, did some janitorial work, and he did recording for the theater company. And at the times that they weren't there using it, he was allowed to do his recording there. So he had this wonderful studio. April 1946, there's a fire, it guts everything, it melts down all those S&D pressings, but he wasn't keeping the masters there. I don't know where he was keeping the masters, but it was not there, so he didn't lose those. Now, here's the sort of the details of the two contracts. So we have those very precise dates. From the looks of things, he paid $500 to Wisconsin Share for the remnants of Paramount. And he didn't get an awful lot for that. He got some medals and some advertising pieces. I think that they probably felt at that point they wanted to get rid of the stuff. And then he sold the recording rights, and theoretically the copyrights to George Buck of GHB Records down in New Orleans in 1970. This is why I'm a little touchy about people recording this presentation, because I'm on good terms with George and I'd like to stay that way. Okay, so here's the new Paramounts. These are 10-inch LP Paramounts. They feature contemporary Chicago musicians, and a lot of them were on red wax. This is the first recording in that series, Chicago Jazz Series 101, and it features Jimmy Yancey. It was recorded December 23rd, 1950, which is about 6 to 8 months before Yancey dies. So if it sounds a little tentative, it's because he's an old man and he's not well. But we're going to give this a spin. What his left hand must have been. It's a little weak here, but must have really been something. Now, this is another one in this series, CJS 105, which is Bud Freeman. These were first released on S&D 78s, and there were a bunch of them. And what Steiner did was he got a whole bunch of these guys who were listed all together for one session. And what he did was break them out. Some of them are the Freeman Five, and that's one group of people, and then the Freeman Four is another group of people. So what you're going to hear, actually, is a little excerpt from The Man I Love, which was done by the Freeman Four, and that's Bud, Tut Soper on piano, Jim Lanigan, who was in the Austin High Gang with Bud, and Jim Barnes on drums. The this is an interesting case, and it shows why it was so important that folks like Hugh Davis and John Steiner were out there recording. They discovered that Cass Simpson was at the Elgin Mental Hospital. They discovered that in 1940, and they were not able to record him. They don't say why, but they did finally manage to get in and record him May 17, 1942. This wasn't released until 1954, and this is after Hugh has already passed away. But it's really a marvelous recording, and we're lucky to have it. This is part of the Blues Variations that's on that album. Whoa, that wasn't supposed to happen. Well, moving along.
Up arrows.
Pardon?
Up arrows.
On the keyboard, sorry. There we go. It's okay. Sometimes these little sound thingies are It's left hands in place. As important as the recordings are, I think that the oral history material is probably even more important, and I'm going to play some of that for you. He interviewed the people who were on the scene, the early scene in jazz, when they were elderly but still really sharp, and their insights are very, very interesting and really are very helpful for people doing research in this area. Sig Meier had the band at White City, and he also had bands in various other early venues in Chicago. He would have been Local 10, which was the White Union. The Black Union was Local 208. And it's very interesting to hear Sig talk about how the musicians sat in across the color line, even in the 20s and 30s.
When you sat in, when you jammed, was it understood that you'd use standard numbers? Nobody would try to trick you with
arrangements? Oh, no. No, it was strictly a friendly deal, and everybody had a good time. Invariably, when I'd on the few nights off that I would get, like on a Friday night, if I went out south to the Midway Garden, and I used to like to listen to them, I would sit in and relieve Peanuts. They just went right along, played their regular program.
And you could play with whatever was familiar to you and whatever you could read. And
that's right.
No demands were put.
Oh, no. Occasionally they'd give you a chorus, and let you spread your wings. But it was a very, very friendly spirit that prevailed at that time.
Did you let people sit in with your band?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
Do you remember anybody?
Well, offhand, as you say that, Darnell would do it many a time at White City before he went to work with Oliver.
King Darnell Oliver. Howard.
Oh, sure. Surely. I thought that's for your own. We'll ignore the public. By the way, Johnny Parmesano or Wingy Minone or any of them, they used to stop by Columbia, you know, and pull out their instrument and stand up in front there and take a few choruses. It was all in good fun.
Wingy must have spent a lot of his time roaming the city because you hear of him sitting in everywhere. In fact, sat in with the Charlie Street Band.
That's right. Well, Muggs used to do that with me long before I had him.
That's Muggsy Spaniard.
After he got so that he was familiar with his trumpet, he would come in and sit in for a few numbers and tootle a few notes, you know, and hit a few blues. And he'd chuckle a little bit and look over, you know. And if you'd give him the nod, he figured it was okay, and he'd toot a few more.
Well, was Muggsy Spaniard from that neighborhood? Seems to me what.
Yes, he was raised or reared. I think his mother had her brood over there at Belmont and Clark, in probably next to where the bank is today.
Mm-hmm. Now, Muggs had his trumpet inspiration somewhere else, didn't he? Who do you think he...
Oh, Oliver. All of them did.
King Oliver.
Oh, yes.
In Chicago.
There's no question. Let's tell it as it is. Every white boy that ever played here got his inspiration from Oliver.
Well, how about
everyone that I can. I believe he did too.
Did you?
Oh, yes. He hung out there. Mm-hmm. He was absolutely the freshest thing in the way of music.
Well, that's why
that
I
hit
question
Chicago.
Whether it was an Oliver influence, whether it might have been either original or another influence.
I doubt it. I doubt it, really and truly. Even though Raymond Lopez came up and, take the New Orleans Rhythm Kings. When they had time off, they spent it out there listening to Oliver.
Other trumpet players from New Orleans, such as Johnny Byersdorfer and Paul Meres, you heard those fellows.
They were influenced by the black trumpeters down in New Orleans. After all, let's call it as it is. They started it. They brought it up from ragtime with their funeral marches and what was played afterwards. These kids were bound to blot up some of it.
It's absolutely remarkable. Absolutely remarkable. He really lays it out on the line.
Where we all used to go on Mondays and Tuesdays in Chicago, Will Easier. That's where we see Mr. Lave at.
Oh, yeah.
Art Labeling.
Up on 31st and State.
What was the name of the store?
Aletha Dickinson and Robert Alexander. They had the music store there. That was but they just went in two names, but that was his wife, you know, Robert Alexander and Aletha. But that was their professional name, you know. They call him Bob Alexander.
Oh, yeah.
He had the Hokeman boys.
Hokeman boys, yeah.
And Aletha Dickinson. Well, she was, talent scout for Labley.
Labley said that he'd come down on Monday and go out, see them, then maybe do some recording on Monday afternoon.
Yeah.
Where'd you do the recording?
I don't know where they did it here. In Chicago,
always went up to Wisconsin.
I went to Grafton, Wisconsin, but I think they would go down there on Wabash down there somewhere.
Lyon Healy Building?
No, it was two something. I think they were recording somewhere down in there. It might have been Lyon Healy. I don't know where they recorded in Chicago because I never did go. But the only way I ever went recorded for him was out in Grafton.
Ink wasn't with them in that.
Well, he had been with them, but they fell out, him and Lavely fell out somehow. Yeah. He had been with them. He had 219. He had office that 219 Wabash, 216 or something like that.
I think that was in the Vocalion, where the Vocalion in Brunswick was recorded.
No, that was 666 Lake Shore Drive. That was up 21st floor. Vocalion had a place there, the Melatone, and all them was upstairs on the 21st floor.
It's really nice to have somebody nail down where those were, and it was probably 216 South Wabash. 219 would have been the other side of the street, and I don't think that there were buildings there then. I'd have to check the survey. Now, John could be, as an interviewer, a little bit of a know-it-all. He was kind of anxious to let everybody know just how much he knew. And you're going to hear little brother Montgomery nail him in this next little excerpt about buildings and venues on Chicago's south side in the 30s.
Well, the old Angeles building was a great building back in then, in the early first of the late 20s and the early 30s. And that was right over from...
on Wabash.
Yeah, right 34th in Wabash.
35th.
34. Yeah, right. 34. He was in the 34th block.
34 or
33. No, between 34th and 33rd.
Stop.
He was just down from the Maker Flat. You know, the Maker Flat was up there where this Illinois Technic thing is there. Yeah. All that. It took up that whole. Well, that old Atlas building, it took in a practically a whole block there, too.
Let's see, Mecca faced on State Street, huh?
Yeah.
And Angelus faced on?
Faced on 35th Street.
Oh, it faced on 35th.
Yeah. It faced 35th. The Angelus building. See, you know, like where the hell is, the face of it was down there, south.
And it's just a parking lot now, and
yeah.
It would be below the elevated platform.
Mm-hmm. And the Grand was up there at 31st State, and the Vendome was up there at 31st Street, but one was on each side of the street.
You can see from the card on the left that he lived in Hyde Park, which even back in the 20s then was a mixed neighborhood. He played a lot of rent parties, you know, where they'd hire a pianist to come in and everybody bring food and throw in some money toward the rent. You got an awful lot of pianists turning up at these things, and you kind of got to know, you know, who was in town and who was a threat and who wasn't. And so he talks here about where he's met some of the other famous Chicago pianists.
You know Cass Simpson in those days?
Yeah.
So you heard from Cass before.
Cass generally played the band jobs on it.
Oh, yeah, well, Cass Simpson, I know a gang, and Jerome Carrington, Cass Simpson, and
Spalding,
Cripple Class Lawford, Jackie.
When did Lawford come along?
Jackie Coogan.
Jackie Coogan.
Yeah, Jackie Coogan.
Same as the movie.
And Toothpick.
Yeah, I've heard of Toothpick.
All them was a hell of a party.
What is Toothpick's name?
45. I don't know his name. And 45. All them were some hell of a piano player. Jackie Coogan was a hell of a piano player.
Who was the one that held his arm out funny? Wing, I guess they called him. Was that before your time?
Cripple Class, you told his arm like that. Who was the Wing?
Well, there was one called Wing.
I didn't know.
I don't know whether it was Clarence. Well, when did Clarence come along?
Clarence was back there.
Before 30?
Sure, he was back there. Clarence was back there in the late 20s.
Clarence had one or two tunes. That was about the extent of his repertoire, wasn't it?
Yeah. It's a gang of them damn piano players, right? Some good ones, right?
Okay, now on the next slide you're going to hear...
You know Cass Simpson in those days?
Yeah.
Stop.
Cass generally played the...
It's a gang. It's a gang of damn piano players. Some good ones. Earl Hines come when he come to Chicago. Well, he practically taken over. You know, for
everybody was a small fry after
when he got you. Boy, he was a bad thing when he got. Boy, he played impossible back in then.
Isn't that great? I wouldn't have wanted to miss that for anything. Okay, after John died on June 3rd, 2000, it took 4 moving van loads to bring his collection down to us. He insisted on putting in the deed of gift that it had to be moved within a month. I spent the entire month of June that year with cobwebs in my hair and mouse shit on my shoes because his basement was a mess and it was all full of strange chemicals. At one point, I put my hand up. I was taking posters out of the ceiling, and I grabbed something, and I went like this, and I went, it was a roll of asbestos. I rolled it back like this, and I went to the other end of the room, and I went, you just never knew what you were going to find down there. We've decided to go ahead and move the Jazz Archive into the Special Collections Research Center at the University of Chicago Library because they had enough HVAC work done that it's now archival conditions down there. And it was sort of an artificial distinction. When the archive was founded in 1976, it was all 78s and Special Collections was all paper. And over the years, you know, when John's collection came, well, there was a lot of paper material. And Special Collections now has tapes of speeches and all kinds of other things. And the curator, the director at Special Collections and I just looked at each other and said, why are these separate? So it's very exciting and it's going to make it an awful lot better for people coming to do research. Here's a little bit of the paper material. These were pluggers. They were used to advertise upcoming events. Many were sponsored by unions and ethnic clubs in the 19-teens. In fact, there was one that I told Ed Ward about that had Irish songs and was for a dance, and we'll make sure that we get a scan to the Irish archives. But you can see here that this is the McCormick Ballroom, Friday evening, April 28, 1922. Elgar's Wonder Band, that's Charlie Elgar, who had the band at the Dreamland. The one below it is the Entertainers Cafe Band. They're at the, you notice they're at the Premier Ballroom. They're not at the Entertainers Cafe. But you can see that there's a fair amount going on. This is December 17, 1921. A lot of the ones from the teens were Bohemian organizations, the Sokol Club, some of the German Turnverein, all different kinds of organizations, union organizations. You know, the cobbler's union might have a party, or the sheet metal fitters, or something like that. So it's an interesting little viewpoint into what life was like in the teens and what people did for entertainment. This was the biggest surprise. I was going through a box of journals, taking them out of the box, giant, huge box, and in the bottom there was a plastic bag. And I grabbed that plastic bag and it was very heavy, and I just happened to grab it so that I was gripping it the way one would grip a 44. And I set it down, and I went and got a cotton glove, and then I opened it up, and sure enough, there was a 44 and a full clip of ammo. So after a conference with my boss, we decided to have the police come and take it away. But I couldn't resist keeping a deaccessioning photo. I really didn't want the student employees to run into that. You know, John went all kinds of places all over Chicago and at night. And he probably carried it for protection, though he never mentioned it, and it sure was a surprise to find it at the bottom of that box. Okay, here's, you know, most of the tapes are not in this bad a shape. I use this picture for examples of why we need grant money to fix things, because it's got all that nice mold all over it. But we've been getting really good transfers off, particularly the red oxide. The black stuff can be problematic. That's stuff from the 70s. But I've been sending out tapes from several of the Chicago Jazz Archive collections, including John's, to be cleaned, baked, and digitized at the Mars Sound Archive at Miller-Nichols Library at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. That's Chuck Haddix's operation. He's a member of ARSC. And Scott the Dude Middleton is the audio engineer down there. I highly recommend them. They do really super good work. And the oral history tapes you heard today are from that project. Here's John and Nina. This was taken about a year before John died. We have to thank them for their forethought in making sure that John's collection went to a repository where it could be used for research. Are there any questions? Yes.
Many years ago, sir, Mike.
Yep.
Mike needs a mic, yes.
Many years ago, John told me that he had gone through the chemical analysis of all the different brands of lacquer recording discs, and that he had devised chemicals for the rejuvenation. Do you have that paperwork?
It's probably in a box somewhere. Four moving van loads of boxes.
But that kind of material was also transferred over to you.
I'm hoping so. Mm-hmm. I've certainly found enough of the scientific information to believe that that kind of thing is going to be there. He was so meticulous about those kinds of things.
Because that would be very valuable. He said it was brand by brand.
It would be really interesting to see that. Unfortunately, right now our collections are under wrapped in plastic because they're putting a sprinkler system into the library. And so we're wrapping everything tight. Vinny.
Debbie, have you found anything in his collection, any previously unknown test pressings or lacquer discs or anything like that that we don't know about?
Four moving van loads.
Okay, understood. Understood.
I think she wants us to come there and check it out for
herself. No, it's literally in the aisles. I can't even get it processed because it's in four, the collections are in four rooms, and every space is taken. You know, I know that there are acetates, and I know that there are 16-inch broadcast discs that are filling one whole aisle that I can't even get in there. We're in the process of trying to transfer this stuff. We're getting it under plastic. Once we get it down into special collections, we'll have a better idea of what's there.
Something I noticed when you were talking about Little Brother Montgomery, something that many people probably have forgotten or didn't know, that and that there was a Riverside album that he appeared on.
Right.
And guest singer was Elaine McFarland, who later, of course, was Spanky McFarland of Spanky and Our Gang. And then later on, she repaid the favor by inviting him on one of her albums. A lot of people never knew she really was a great blues singer in addition to a sort of a rockish kind of pop singer.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the Riverside recordings because John did a lot of recording and licensed things out to a lot of labels. And Riverside was one of them. I know that there are tapes that say Riverside on them. So, you know, it's going to take years to sort out what was actually John's stuff. That Little Brother Montgomery clip that you heard was an unissued Savoy pressing, but the date is suspicious. It's 1949 in Chicago, and I would lay money on it that maybe John Steiner and Hugh Davis had a hand in that. I don't know for sure because the documentation was not good on it. I found it on a document reissue. But the date is certainly consistent with what Hugh and John were doing in 1949 in Chicago. And I have seen other things in John's collection indicating that he may have licensed things to Savoy. More questions? Thank you very much for coming. And I have to publicly thank my colleague and friend Barbara Need for lending me her laptop because mine died yesterday during the sound check. And the sound guys, Ben and Matt and Scott, who've just been marvelous in helping me pull this presentation back together after the meltdown.
Yep, thank you very much. Hannah and Lauren have provided us with a fact sheet that you're welcome to come up and come up here and pick up on your way out. Thank you very much for this morning's presentation, all.